If you think back over the course of your morning, turning on the lights, making your coffee, turning on the radio to WNYC, of course, how much electricity do you think you used and where did it come from? Well, today on Please Explain, we're going to talk about our electrical power system, how electricity is made and how it's transmitted and used. And joining me now are Dr. Michael Karamanis, Boston University Professor of Mechanical and Systems Engineering, and Dr. Robert Thomas, a professor of electrical and computer engineering at Cornell University. And I'm very pleased to welcome them to our show. Hi.
Hello. Good morning.
Dr. Thomas, to start, as we always do, and please explain with basic terms, what is electricity at the most basic level? I understand that the definition requires some understanding of subatomic particles, including electrons.
I suppose you can understand it at that level, but I don't think you really have to understand that stuff to be able to understand how it works at a user level. That's more useful if you want to design and engineer and build these systems, but to understand how it works, it's like you don't have to understand how an oil refinery works to be able to drive a car very well.
But I'm talking about just understanding what oil is and how oil came about. I mean, electricity, is that something that, it does occur naturally in lightning, but does it occur naturally anywhere else?
I suppose, inside the body there's electricity going on all the time between the cells. But I think the basic understanding that you need is you need to understand the difference between energy and power. Mm-hmm. I think people see the electric power plants and are aware of the fact that they're built for electric energy. So energy is the capacity for doing work. As an analogy, you might think about it as the gas in the tank in your car. And power is the rate at which the work's done. Equivalently, that's the energy that you use. It's the horsepower under the hood of the car. So electricity's units of power are the watt. And in a car, it's the horsepower. They're really the same things. One's mechanical, one's electrical.
Electricity is a secondary source of energy, and primary sources, at least in the United States, are coal 49%, natural gas 21%, nuclear energy 16%, solar and wind power approximately 1% each. Dr. Karamanis, does that differ much in other countries?
It does, but it also does among states in the United States. The average that you gave is pretty characteristic of what is happening the world over. If you look at France, for example, more than 70% of the electricity is generated from nuclear power plants. If you look at Denmark, about 20% of the electric energy is generated from wind farms. In Spain, about 10-15% is generated from wind farms. So there are some changes, some differences. Same is true with the United States. In Oregon, for example, we have more than 5% of the energy generated from renewable energy sources, wind being the most important of them.
Well, how are these fuels converted into electricity?
Well, when fuel, conventional fuel, is burned, it creates energy in the form of pressure and in the form of heat, which then drives a motor, and that motor converts that chemical energy, which is embodied in a conventional fuel, a fossil fuel, into electricity. We can convert electricity back to heat. We can convert electricity to light, just like we can convert light to electricity. The photovoltaic power plants, photovoltaic panels, for example, do just that. So we are able to convert one form of energy to the other. Fossil fuels, which we think of as a primary source of energy, contain energy in their chemical bonds. So if the chemical bonds break, then they release heat and pressure in terms of the combustion gases, which are converted to other forms of energy.
Well, I understand all of that in the way a car might be driven, but I'm not sure I understand how the breaking down of a hydrocarbon or nuclear energy or a steam turbine actually makes electricity.
Well, a steam turbine, as the word suggests, operates with steam, right? So, mm-hmm. So if we burn fuel, we can generate heat. That heat can create steam by heating water, and then that steam has a lot of pressure, which can move a turbine, can twist a turbine, and that twisting using electromagnetic laws of physics can generate electricity, which you can think of, as Professor Thomas said, as a sort of difference in potential. You can think of electric power as being the difference between voltage at one end and voltage at the other, and electricity tends to flow from high voltage to low voltage, just like water flows from a high elevation to a low elevation.
Well, Dr. Thomas, how is that electrical power harnessed and transmitted to us? How do we get it?
Michael has explained the generation cycle. The steam cycle, which is probably the way 80% of the power is generated worldwide, can convert, the steam cycle itself can convert any of the fossil fuels and nuclear to electricity. And basically, it rotates an electric machine. This electric machine, as you said, produces a voltage and a current, and then that's in the U.S., the bulk of our system is what's called an AC system. That means that the voltage and therefore the current goes up and it goes down 60 times per second. That allows us to transform the voltage to very high levels and send it over the wires that you see running down the road and from one substation to another. And then the voltage is dropped back down to the various levels that it's needed. At the household, it's 220 volts when you see it. The wires that are overhead in your house can be a much higher voltage. You see the little transformers up on the poles. At businesses, they're usually at a 480-volt level. And this all has to do with the kind of load that's being serviced by the electricity.
I understand there are some 160,000 miles of high-voltage wire carrying power across the country from about 1,600 generating stations. But some of it is carried pretty far. Is that an efficient way of carrying electricity? Generating it, let's say, in Niagara Falls and then sending it down to Philadelphia?
It doesn't exactly work that way. That's like asking, if you have a large lake and you have a bunch of pipes that are, filling up the lake, and you have a bunch of places that you're taking it out of, you can't really track the water from one pipe to an outlet at another. It just sort of goes in the lake and raises the level and it comes out. And the grid's very much like that. You stick in power at points, and it's distributed around the grid system according to what's called Kirchhoff's laws, and it comes out at the load, where it's needed. So the trick here is to make sure that you have enough going in to service the losses in transmitting it, plus the load itself, the conservation of energy.
My guests are Dr. Robert Thomas, a professor of electrical and computer engineering at Cornell University, and Dr. Michael Karamanis, Boston University professor of mechanical and systems engineering. We're talking about electricity and its transmission on today's Please Explain, and we invite your calls at 212-433-9692. You can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate, and this is WNYC and WNYC.org. If I remember correctly, Thomas Alva Edison preferred DC to AC as the current standard. What are the differences, and why did he lose that fight?
Yes, that's correct. He wanted to do DC. The first thing that's interesting is that all generation, these rotational machines that generate the electric power, are naturally AC. This stuff is produced very naturally AC. He figured out a mechanical commutation system to turn that into DC because at that time, I think he understood DC better than he did the AC stuff. That was very early in our understanding of how all this stuff worked. But really what hurt him were two things. One was that the transmission losses associated with DC are quite high. And if you can step this voltage up to these very high levels, we use 345 kilovolts, 500 kilovolts, 765. The higher you can get the voltage, the lower the losses in transmission will be. There was no way at the time to step DC up to very high voltages, so that hurt him. And the second thing was that he hadn't figured out a good metering system. They used to meter electricity by simply looking at the transfer of a chemical process and then weighing the amount of transfer that occurred. That's how they would meter it. With the AC stuff, you can run motors and you can meter it very efficiently. So in the end, the ability to step up the voltage and to actually meter the stuff very well is why Westinghouse and Tesla won the wars.
Dr. Karamanis, what are the high voltage wires made of? I'm assuming that they have to be made of special stuff to be able to carry electricity efficiently and also not be worn out by it, not be harmed by it.
Well, they're made out of metal, and the ones that you see, the overhead wires that you see, are practically metal, but there are other types of wires that have insulation layers and sort of different layers in it, different components that allow us to transport the electricity more safely.
We not only do it above ground, but we do it below ground and sometimes underwater.
Yes, that is correct. And as a matter of fact, direct current is, as far as underwater transportation of electricity is concerned, is sort of gaining the upper hand because of certain advantages that it has. However,
which are
mostly now the transportation is above ground. In big cities, we have underground transportation.
And why is it better underwater?
Why is direct current better underwater?
Mm-hmm.
Because it does not need cooling, and you need much less mm-hmm. mass to transport the electricity. The AC current, in order to transport AC current, you need to have oil and other coolants to make it possible. However, the big disadvantage of DC, which might be considered as having lost the battle because of technical conditions at the time, and one might think that might argue that the alternating current has taken the upper hand because of a sort of historical and technological curiosity. So DC is coming back as something that is considered to be beneficial, particularly because of uses such as computer consumption of electricity that that depend on DC. However, the big disadvantage of direct current is the cost of transforming it from high voltage, which is something that you needed in order to transport electricity long distance, and that's why for very long distances DC might be is advantageous. And we do have some direct current connections. For example, Canada is connected with New England through a direct current line. But in order to be able to safely use electricity in the home, we need to step it down. And if you step it down and you have electricity circulating, if you step it down only once and you have electricity circulating along a, let's say, a big city at a low voltage level, then you incur exceedingly high losses. So direct current is still disadvantaged greatly by the cost of transforming it, whereas alternating current can be very inexpensively transformed from to either a higher voltage or to a much lower voltage level, which is safe in the home.
Dr. Thomas, the origins of our grid system or transmission system date back to the late 1800s, as I understand it, with the first very modest distribution system in Great Barrington, Massachusetts. Are there aspects of the history of our electrical power system that strike you as important for us to understand as we consider changes now, at a time when we depend so much more on electricity because, you know, just the introduction of computers has caused a tremendous outgrowth, a tremendous growth in our use of electricity?
I think the first commercial system was actually Thomas Edison's in 1882 in New York City, his Pearl Street station.
Mm-hmm.
And what was interesting about Edison was that, you know, he didn't just invent a light bulb and a giant, he invented a whole business. He understood that it was the whole electricity business that was important, not just the components of it.
That's why we have Con Edison in New York?
Mm-hmm. And, of course, he was the owner of General Electric in the beginning. He did a lot. Actually, the first street lighting system was up here on Cornell's campus back in that era. But there are things. The electricity industry has undergone incredible transformations. You know, it was voted by the National Academy as at the turn of the century as the single engineering feat that had the greatest impact on people's lives in the 19th century, in the 20th century. So it started out as a business model that was very entrepreneurial, and it progressed to finally to a monopolistic system, and now it's sort of going back to some of the more entrepreneurial things in, as we restructure the generation and hopefully the load in the long run to a different way of doing business. So the business models for this have changed, as have the technologies. And the biggest technologies that you hear about now in the change is the transitioning to what people are referring to as the smart grid.
We'll come back to that.
It's constantly in change in both its institutional arrangements and its technical structure.
We'll come back to discussion of the grids because a number of listeners are already calling in with questions about the smart grid and related matters. As we continue this conversation on Please Explain with Dr. Robert Thomas, a professor of electrical and computer engineering at Cornell University, and Dr. Michael Karamanis of Boston University. He's a professor of mechanical and systems engineering. And our number here is 212-433-9692. You can also leave a comment on our show page at WNYC.org. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Back with Please Explain, and our guest, Dr. Michael Karamanis, Boston University professor of mechanical and systems engineering, And Dr. Robert Thomas, a professor of electrical and computer engineering at Cornell University. He has worked with the U.S. Department of Energy, Office of Electrical Energy Systems in Washington, D.C., and the National Science Foundation as the first program director for power systems programs in the Engineering Doctorates Division of Electrical Systems Engineering. And we're taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Mario from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi there. I'm going to bring this to a very pedestrian level. When I look at my outlets in my apartment, I know that with AC, you don't have a positive and negative wire. You've got what's called a hot wire and a neutral wire. And my question is this. If alternating current is a dual polarity, in other words, it goes in both directions, how is it delivered on a single wire? And my other question is, how is a neutral wire different from a ground wire?
Which one of you wants to answer that? Dr. Thomas, let's begin with you.
Yes, I can try. Yeah. First of all, it does take two wires. It takes two wires. And the two wires can be at any level you want. It just matters what the voltage is with respect to each other.
Oh.
So you can have an alternating current that alternates about 100 volts. It goes up 100 and down 100, and that's okay. That isn't typically what we would like to do, so we reference one of the wires to zero so that the other wire goes up 110 volts with respect to the neutral wire, the zero, and then it goes below that with respect to that same wire. So it actually does go up and down with respect to zero.
And then we have a third prong for
right.
some of the appliances that have heavier electrical loads.
That third prong is important because that actually is a ground wire that goes to a wire that goes into the ground near your apartment building, or I mean, it's literally a pole in the ground to which a wire is connected. Now, the neutral wire should be at the same potential as that ground wire all the time. If something goes wrong, you want able to tell that something's gone wrong with respect to those two, whether it's at ground or whether it's at some other potential. And so there's a third wire that is always at that ground potential in which when you're standing on the ground and you're in a puddle of water and you touch a neutral wire, you won't get shocked.
Do you want to add anything to that, Dr. Karamanis, or should I go to the next call?
No, I think it was very nicely.
Okay, let's invite Sean from Bradley Beach onto our show. Hi, Sean.
How you doing, gentlemen? I'm an electrician, and I see the wonderful potential in the smart grid, especially through renewables. It's also kind of funny how Edison's original ideas for local power generation at the end of people's streets and in fake homes with diesel generators at the end of a street when he was thinking DC is kind of coming full circle with photovoltaics on roofs. So you put photovoltaic on your roof, and then your neighbor's getting the benefit of some of your electricity. It's almost like having local generation. But what my question is we're being told from civil engineers in this country that we have a third world transmission and delivery system, and it's getting further and further behind, and we cannot make the industrial leaps and bounds that we're going to need to the 21st century because China's going to outspend us on their electrical grid, and if we don't get to the smart grid, which would make the usage of renewables better and easier for them to do, because the power companies push back against hooking up. There are wind farms all over the country, I hear, that aren't even connected to the grid because the local power utilities say it's too hard to manage the up and down flow of the electricity. Will the smart grid help? That is my final question.
Dr. Karamanis.
Certainly the smart grid. First of all, let me say that it's an exaggeration that we have a third world grid. it's our grid is pretty smart, particularly upstream at the high voltage level, the transmission part of the transmission and distribution network.
Although we do have an occasional brownout or worse, don't we?
Yes, we do. But I don't think we've been less reliable than any other place in the world, including Western Europe, where, for example, they had their own blackout in 2003-2004. So we do have a rather reliable system with occasional failures, and we can discuss what was the cause of the 2003 blackout. Where we are still missing smarts in the smart grid is downstream at the distribution at the medium and low voltage level, and that indeed is extremely important for incorporating for integrating renewable energy generation, which has the major drawback of being intermittent and being non-controllable. We cannot control when wind farms or photovoltaic arrays produce electricity. In order to be able to deal with this sort of lack of control or intermittency, I think that it behooves us to make sure that there are many more participants in the power system markets, and whereas right now markets do exist in which you have a couple of hundred, maybe participants, a few hundred participants consisting of big generators and big wholesale traders of electricity. Small consumers cannot participate. If with the advent of the smart grid, with our ability to measure what is happening, to understand the condition of our system, not only will we be able to manage it and operate it more efficiently, but also we will be able to allow smaller consumers to participate, either directly or through load aggregators, through energy service companies, that will make it possible for load to follow, to adjust to the varying supply of electricity from those intermittent renewable forces. So the smart grid has a great role to play in making the operation and maintenance of our distribution system more efficient, and also in making it much more resilient, expanding our ability to use it to serve much more load, because we'll be able to fill valleys, in other words, use the distribution system during times that there is excess capacity. In order to do that, we have to groom, we have to adjust to manage our loads. And to do that, we need information, and the smart grid is going to provide this information.
We have a call from Greg from New Jersey who has a follow-up on the smart grid. Is there anything else you want to ask about it, Greg? Or have your questions been answered?
You answered most of it. The other question I have is, in 3 to 5 years, when you talk about smart grid technology, to the everyday consumer in the home, what does that equate to, and how does that directly affect me and my family? And I'll take the answer off the air.
Okay, thank you for calling. Dr. Thomas, you want to take that?
Mm-hmm. Sure. Michael's right in that the early impacts of the smart grid are going to be down at the consumer level. It's going to allow consumers to have a voice in their consumption. Right now, you simply turn on a light, it lights up, you turn it off, and you're billed at a flat rate for its use. The cost of generating that watt for your light bulb varies depending on what generation is online, what loads are out there. At high load periods, it costs much more to generate than it does at low load periods. If you can manage your household at according to your interest in payments. If you want to lower your payments, for example, you should be able to know what does it really cost me for this watt, and can I delay things or do things otherwise? For example, can I tell my dishwasher that I want to wash my dishes when the price of electricity is low instead of turning it on whenever I feel like it? When all households are able to participate in that way, and it doesn't mean you have to change your quality of life, it simply means you have choices that you never had before, it should benefit us all, because we'll be able to use the system much more efficiently, we'll be able to use the generation we have much more efficiently, and that should benefit everybody, including the listener's family. I would like to say one other thing with respect to the last caller, and that is he's right in that we would like to get this generation down at the loads. Edison started that way, which made sense. There was an economy of scale to going to these extremely large generation and transmission. You save a lot of money by doing that. But it's true, we would like to get more. But the distribution systems that are out there were never designed for having generation in them. You can imagine, for example, a simple problem that the electrician will face is if everybody's got generation on the distribution system and the utility wants to take it down for repair, they do a disconnect at a substation of what they think is all the feeds into the distribution system, but somebody's got their generator on there. Electrician now goes to fix it, and there's voltage on the wires. So the safety issues, the protection issues, all of those things mean that the distribution systems are going to have to be designed differently, and that'll take time.
We have very little time left, but I wanted to sneak Peter from Riverdale in. Peter, can you make it quick? And I hope that the answer could be brief.
Yeah, I wonder what the relative environmental impact is of, say, on the one hand, directly using fossil fuel, and on the other hand, converting fossil fuel to electricity, which is where you said most of the electricity originally comes from. Is that quick enough?
Yeah. Thank you so much for your call, Peter. Either of you want to tackle that? Dr. Karamanis?
Yes, very quickly. We now have very efficient ways of converting fossil fuel to electricity, and then you can convert electricity to other uses at a very high high efficiency level, almost 90% or so. So it seems to me that using, for example, heat pumps to condition our homes will be saving and conserving fuels relative to burning fuels directly for that purpose, and particularly, of course, on the cooling side.
A listener wanted to know how much energy we actually lose in the transmission of electricity.
Because we can go to these very, very high voltages at the transmission level, the very high voltage stuff, it's about 3%. At the distribution level, where the voltages are much lower, it's higher.
Mm-hmm. Is anything lost in transforming through the transforming process?
Sure. All of these things have losses in them, and you just need to try to minimize them. They're not that great. At the large transformers are at the 3% level. The smaller ones are a little higher.
Just very quickly, because we do have a moment. David in Montclair wonders, can someone explain batteries? How or what is the electricity inside?
Batteries are a chemical process where you're converting, and it's a much different process than this rotating machinery process that we've been talking about. So typically, I guess that's all I can say. I'm not an expert in batteries, but the
what do you know, Dr. Karamanis? I mean, why do we get electricity just as we get electricity from the other process?
Well, you can think of it very simply as ions, in other words, molecules that are positively and negatively charged, that are sort of separated and created and stored in a battery. And of course, the lithium-ion battery, for example, is a very efficient way of storing electricity.
Well, we have to leave it there, unfortunately. And I want to thank the two of you so much for participating. And please explain today, Dr. Michael Karamanis, Boston University Professor of Mechanical and Systems Engineering, Dr. Robert Thomas, a Professor of Electrical and Computer Engineering at Cornell University. Thanks again.
You're welcome.
On Monday's show, we'll take a look at how the American and Chinese economies have become one fused codependent system, and then celebrity chef David Chang on his first cookbook, Momofuku. Also, a look at the life of conductor Valerie Gergiev with Academy Award-winning director Alan Miller. Plus, we'll examine how younger Americans are rewriting the rules of entrepreneurship. The Let It Lopez Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Drew Katchen, Ida Sadakiani, and contributing producer Bonnie LaFave. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Let It Lopez, your host. Thanks for listening. Enjoy your weekend. We'll see you on Monday.